We are absolutely thrilled today to have one of our top digital health leaders in the whole country on our program. She is an amazing leader, a role model for so many in our industry. She's an award-winning leader in many, many respects. But most importantly, she's truly respected, highly respected across our entire country for her leadership, the way she cares for her people, and just her ability to help patient care get delivered. We're thrilled to have Phyllis Teeter, the Chief Information Officer and Associate VP for Health Services at, I'm going to try to say this correctly, the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to the program, Phyllis.
Thank you so much, Russ, and thank you for having me. It's great to see you and hear you and be able to talk about our work here.
Well, first and foremost, let's keep it really personal here. How are you doing? How's your family doing? How is your team doing during these difficult times?
I am very blessed. All of those are fine and still doing well, as well as we all can. But I think that my family is all doing well, and doing graduate school and undergraduate school, and my husband is doing well, so very good. And then my team is doing well, but it has been difficult, and we're going to talk a little bit about that and how do you keeping them engaged and feel like they're part of our IT family when we're not together. So that's the hardest part. So
yeah, let's just jump right into that, because I know it just so happens you're in the office today recording that, but that isn't the norm necessarily. But a lot of your team, just like a lot of the teams across the country, really across the world, are still remote working or really kind of disconnected physically from the workplace. You know, how's that challenges of that, and how are you handling that from a team perspective?
Well, it has been very difficult. You know, we do have, like all, I think, IT departments at medical centers, we do have a portion of our team that have been in almost every day since the beginning, because they have hands-on responsibilities. And that would be our field services team that, you know, work on our equipment, work on our network, fix problems. We still have major projects underway to install new, you know, our yearly allotment of new wireless access points. So we still have a group that is in. And so we try to do things to recognize them for being really on the lines with our clinician partners to be able to deliver service when, you know, so many of their peers in IT are able to be at home and feeling safer because they are able to be, you know, not having to come to work every day. So but the rest of the team, you're correct, are at home. And I think it was quite a whirlwind both for to set up our staff, but as all IT departments, we also needed to help the rest of our workforce that could work from home figure that out technologically. And so, you know, how to do that in such a way that that they continue to remain productive and serve our patients and the other caregivers through this process was quite an accomplishment, I think. And I think some of the things we do to try to still remain together is during the early part of the pandemic, particularly when we were seeing our surge and most places were from March through June, we did started almost right away both a daily huddle of all managers, and then we cascade that up through and down through our organization and make sure that, you know, right after the huddle of all managers met with their team and passed on information. We did things like once in a while we'd make it Funny Hat Day. So all of your IT Zoom, you know, Zoom or WebEx or Teams or all of the things, meetings would be, you had to wear your funny hat. And so we tried to find ways to really do things that that could help us continue to connect. We did start a daily newsletter that helped to keep folks up to date on the changing environment, what was going on with us building stations for swabbing, with us outfitting our convention center here in Central Iowa, all of the big projects underway. And we got about a week into that and we decided we needed a section of the newsletter that was just for fun. And so we published pictures of everybody's pets. We did a couple of rounds of that. We published good recipes, people's favorite recipes they could publish. We culled some of the other daily newsletters for fun things. Like we had a recipe for scones that came from somebody famous that somebody told me they and their kids baked. We had things for their kids to color. We really tried to make it a little bit, call it on the lighter side, something that could be consumed by our folks that wasn't as heavy as all of the other things that we were all dealing with. So a lot of work on that. And I feel like we made an impact in trying to make still have folks feel part of our family. So
that's amazing. I know, especially in some of the larger academic centers, it's just so big and so spread out anyway. And especially when something like this hits, what are some of the other key learnings from your organization that you've kind of kept your mind on as this kind of has transpired and now you're into the next phase of it? I hate calling it new normal or normal or whatever in the next right. round of craziness, but kind of what's that world look like? What are some learnings?
So some great learnings. I think one of the things that we realized is that we're a big academic medical center, might be a little bureaucratic. We're also part of one of the biggest universities in the country. And so we don't do things very fast. But when we have the appropriate focus and are all pulling together towards a goal, we can get stuff done really fast. Somebody had told me I would get the entire, part of the workforce of the medical center able to work from home in about a week, I would have told them they were crazy. Mm-hmm. That. And so I think that speed at which we can, if we can focus, the speed which we can achieve in things is astounding. And so we're trying to capitalize on that and use it wisely once. And, as we look at something, we decide it's very important. We put a lot of focus on it and can get some things done in a very short time. So the other piece was that we really needed to reduce our complexity. And so a number of efforts underway to think about how we can make our user environment, our technical environment, all of the things that add to the complexity of supporting a large academic medical center, how can we start to shave them down? Because it makes us less nimble. And it taught us the importance of being nimble when we were going through the early days, especially of the pandemic.
So how do you make that sticky? How do you maintain that? I love that concept of less complexity, speed, that kind of that concept of agility. How do you, as things, I hate saying normalize, and normalize could mean going back to bureaucracy. How do you not go back there?
It's hard. It's where we're comfortable. being part of this organization myself for 29 years, it is definitely where we're comfortable here. And so I think we try to be deliberate about picking those things because we can't, our organization tends towards that. And you certainly can't have that kind of speed and focus with everything. So it's about picking them, recognizing them, and then creating a different process. But you can't do it for everything. So, we try to have, one or two things that we may be looking at in that way and differentiate sort of our energy to focus on those things that we've looked at to be really top of mind.
Yeah, I would imagine that being CIO of a large academic system, there's just, forget COVID for a second, there's just natural challenges to the size of something that big and trying to create change and lead through change during that time. What are some of those challenges that maybe even were magnified by COVID?
I think that serving our three missions, we don't have a single mission because of the academic influence. We have the mission of patient care, and certainly from a scale and size perspective, it's the farthest by, largest by far. And but we still are here because we support and inside a university because we're linked to the academic missions of research and education. And so that is, you know, something that's always a little bit of a challenge. They certainly complement each other, but I wouldn't say they're all moving in the same direction always. And I think some of the security challenges that having a large research and academic enterprise that has to have different kinds of connections to the outside world is something that, you know, is an example of something that is complicated in order to make sure that you are serving the unique needs of the different missions.
So let's. I mentioned in your introduction being such a role model for some, but there's definitely some unique traits of you personally and your position there. Let's talk a little bit about you. Tell us a little bit about your story of how you got where you are. You did mention you were there for 29 years, but it sounds like you're a Buckeye even maybe a little prior to 29 years. So we'd love to hear a little bit about your story.
Well, I started my job as a computer programmer in 1991 when we still were building our own clinical repository. I had a brand new degree from The Ohio State University in computer programming. And I think at the time the healthcare mission appealed to me because it's not, it has a higher calling in terms of the service that we provide to our patients and really helping people to live healthier and improved lives. And so I started here as a programmer, but with very, you know, with skills that were just very much, you know, I could have taken, I actually had some other offers, but the healthcare. And so I came here and I've been here ever since. And now I'm very blessed to lead the department in which I've worked in for 29 years. And I am a lifetime Buckeye. And I went to school here. I have kids that go to school here. I've worked here, but all my children were born in the hospital that I support their systems. And so I'm very connected and I wouldn't be anywhere else.
Wow, that is 29 years in the same place is that might be a record. I mean, there may be somebody else that's a CIO that's done that, but I'm sure not aware of it. Most of the average tenure is about 3 to 5 years. So
yeah, I know. I've been CIO now for 10 years, almost 11. So
that alone is an anomaly. Never mind the 30 years. Well, that's an amazing story. You probably can't feel anything more than just being home for you every single day. That's a blessing.
Absolutely.
So obviously, one of the things you mentioned and using the word bureaucracy, you know, just big organizations by nature, sometimes you need discipline. Sometimes you need things that help shape that. And for you, I know that you really have a passion and a skill set towards helping with IT governance. So I'd love to hear about kind of your thoughts on IT governance and how that kind of helps shape your organization.
So I think that governance has a role, especially when you think about the allocation of our scarce resources. So the days are gone when there were even better ideas that came forward because they get squashed even before they come forward for consideration because there are so many good ideas and great and outstanding. And I think the opportunities for technology and healthcare have just abounded now for so long that I think that but an endless stream of resources is not available to accomplish all those wonderful ideas. And so the primary thing that we use our governance structure for is to help us think about priorities, to help us to set methodologies for priorities on small projects, because certainly our governance structure does not review every single thing we do. But also on the big things where we maybe are making a capital investment or a significant operating investment, is that we need to hear from the organization. IT is not is a service that enables the other services that we get, that we provide. It is not a service that exists and contributes by itself, right? It is about helping the other areas to deliver better and more efficient services. And so in our governance structure, we do have an oversight group that is populated by the three mission leaders for clinical care, education, and research. And they help us at the highest level prioritize our capital investments and be able to make sure that we are including the right stakeholders in that. But then we have a group that helps at the next level down in those three mission areas that helps us to prioritize the smaller projects and really makes recommendations to our oversight group. I think that it is important because it helps the organization. They know that it's always difficult to make those prioritizations, but if you have a well-invested set of champions on your governance structure, it makes it a little easier for the organization to understand that that there are not unlimited resources and to sort of live with the priorities that we have to instill. So
when it's going really well, when governance is doing its job and it's really focused, what does that look like? What's the positive outcome that comes from that?
I think it's an organizational buy-in for change. At the end of the day, most of what we do is about changing the organization, changing somebody to a new system, changing their email, changing their access to systems, as we are affecting their job. And so a well-run organization is helping to set priorities, to focus on the very best things from a governance perspective, and then helping to make sure that those people that are helping set the priorities are influencers. They have to be influencers so they can really help the organization to buy in to the changes that we're oftentimes foisting upon them and helping them to really make the transition from the way that we did things, maybe in the system or maybe on paper, to the way that we need to do things now.
So on that same subject, on that same thought process, so much about what you mentioned was really about helping people through change. And you know, I know you're passionate about this, that helping people develop and mentor them and help them just through life change. I mean, you're a great example of that, starting all the way from a bachelor's degree to running the whole show. That's such a testament of development. And I'm sure there were great people that helped you along the way. Why are you so passionate about this?
So I come at this from really a servant leader sort of, and I think that that is true. Without the people that had given me advice, provided me with development opportunities or mentored me, I would be nowhere. It is a team sport in terms of advancing our up-and-coming leaders. And I really have learned so much, and I think we all do, from the experience of the years that I've been here. I really, and this phrase is a little overused these days, it's a real privilege for me to flatten the curve for other up-and-coming leaders and help them to make make a bigger difference because they can learn from the experiences that I have had.
Well, let's unsugarcoat that just a little bit here, because you are a great example and a great role model for all leaders, without a doubt. But there are not as many great role model female leaders in health IT, not just in healthcare, at a macro level across all IT. You know, what do you think we can do to make, I don't want to say make it easier, because there's nothing about it that will ever be easy. How do we remove barriers to make it possible for more females to get involved in health IT and to be able to succeed?
So I think there's a whole set of strategies, and some of the ones that I think are so important and that we've been working on here is that we have a actually award-winning arm of our College of Medicine that does implicit bias training and research, and to help folks understand, all of us understand our own implicit biases. I myself have taken taken some testing and received quite a bit of training on implicit bias, and I found out that I even have some biases against women. You would think, I would think anyway, that I that wasn't possible. I'm shining example of a woman that's been able to be a leader, but you know, we all have some of that, even maybe when we think we don't. And so that's kind of the first thing that I think helps, is to make sure that we are recognizing that and providing tools to folks, because just recognizing that in yourself, right, as shown through research, helps to change the game. So that's really about changing ourselves. And I think that thinking about our processes, and you know, when you get a pool, I had a position I was recruiting for where I got over 100 resumes, senior leader, our chief technical officer actually, and I had two women in the whole entire field of resumes. And so not taking that for an answer. And when you get a pool of candidates for a position, and you feel like the pool is lacking, spend the extra time trying to increase the pool of applicants to include women as well as other minorities, right? The same thing for combating racism and thinking about our implicit biases in that space, is that to be deliberate about thinking about changing the game from that perspective. The other piece I think that is so important is to think about the pipeline. And I know it's not all a pipeline problem, but it is in part. And when I think about young girls who might want to take an engineering class in high school, but they have to be in a class that is going to be 80% high school boys, that's pretty rough, being in a class. One of my daughters was in a class where she was the only girl in a beginning engineering class in high school. And so thinking about how do we ease that transition, one of our high schools has an all-girl engineering class. And no matter what size or how many applicants they get, they make it all girls. And so again, it's about the deliberate actions that we can take to be able to have young women see themselves as somebody that could make a contribution in a technological field. It's all of STEM, but certainly in IT is where my passion lies, is how do we have young women see themselves doing that job?
Today's segment of the Digital Health Leaders Podcast was brought to you by our supporter, LK.
Yeah, it's funny. I've had this on a couple of the other podcasts where I've actually mentioned this. And my daughter, who just recently graduated with her bachelor's of science, and I remember in high school when she came home to tell me she got accepted for the STEM program. And we talked for about 5 minutes. Then she looked at me and said, "What's a STEM?" So I said, "Okay, let me explain this to you. You're really good at math. You're really good at math and science. And that's what two of the words stand for." And she goes, "Oh, well, that makes sense then." She had no idea what she'd gotten accepted for. And I mean, that's just a perfect example of, you know, helping people through it. And, you know, I think the other area that's interesting is it's, and I think some easy is, again, not the right word. There's a natural affinity for you to want to focus on helping females, but that's not where you've drawn the line. I mean, listening to the way you talk, this is for you about being deliberate across the board. And I know you've done the exact same things in trying to help and work with minority populations as well. You want to maybe give us a little clue on that?
Absolutely. I think that, that again, it's much of the same practical things, you know, recognizing in yourself, understanding yourself, understanding others, encouraging others. We went through a process, and when the implicit bias training became more available, we were one of the departments that decided that we would make it mandatory for every single manager right away. That would be our first effort, was to make sure that every manager took the class, took the test, understood themselves to help in their decision-making and being absolutely sure that that they were as self-aware in these areas as they can. And then to really encourage that broadening of the pool, we work with our HR recruiters to try to say, nope, you know, I do not have a diverse enough pool for this position. Go back to the board, get me some diversity, you know, and we call around, we, you know, do a lot of that kind of work. It's just really so important. I am fortunate to have a diverse team that works as at a senior leader level in IT. And I think the creativity that diversity brings is wonderful and just really a credit to our organization, allows us to do things that we probably couldn't do if we had a less diverse team. So
that's, we may have to do another program someday just on that alone and bring a couple different people along in with yourself, because I think that's just some of the epiphanies there are just so profound in helping people go through that. That's amazing. That's just amazing leadership. So as we look forward, there's a lot that's coming about in healthcare. New technologies, new ways of doing things, big buzzwordy things like transformed healthcare and digital health, which I'm 100% bought into, but we're really entering into a whole new era of, for lack of a better term, cool technology that's going to really aid in some of those benefits. AI, machine learning, robotics, you can go on and on, drones, all kinds of crazy stuff. You know, you're a big academic research center. You probably have people testing everything. There's probably the next new robot there somewhere that we don't even know about. But how do you approach this and marry those ideas, which can be a little bit science fiction, with we're going to deliver new and exciting care and engage people in their homes and all. How do you marry all that up?
It's hard because I think these new technologies have unique challenges. I think, you know, we like many places have an RPA, robotic process automation effort underway to look at that. And that's threatening for individuals because I think that they feel, you know, often feel like, you know, the days when we thought every job would be replaced by a robot are starting to feel that way. And so how do you help the organization through that and really help them to understand that the opportunities to do things where that are more valuable and probably more fun abound, and that being able to have less of our workforce having to do things that that can be done in better ways and more efficient ways allows us to really move the needle. So a lot going in that area, but really being sensitive to how that can feel to our staff. And then ML and AI, and certainly some of those things have the what they're calling the black box problem. And it's especially prevalent, I think, in healthcare, because a physician or a caregiver is very highly trained technically. And for them to trust that an algorithm that they can't understand truthfully because it's, you know, programmed into some high level ML language, that algorithm is giving them, you know, the answer without them maybe understanding the calculation that produced that. That is difficult. They exist on evidence, and for them to know that the answer that they're getting can help them make a decision is quite difficult, I think, just because of the brilliance of our care providers. In an academic setting, you are correct, we are fortunate to have very deep experts in many of these technologies. We have a translational data analytics group that was stood up at the university that helps all of the areas of the university really to think about using data analytics, some of these new applied technologies, to be able to really change the game in a research environment, most assuredly, but also in our transactional environments like patient care, where we're trying to to change the game for each specific patient and get better and better information to deliver better care. So.
Wow. Well, I look forward to seeing the next really cool robot coming out of The Ohio State University. So, or at least something. That sounds just amazing. So, with a little bit of time that we have left as our time kind of closes out, well, we all were influenced with lots of different people in our lives and different leadership philosophies. I'd love for you to just kind of share one last thought or some wisdom on your philosophies or philosophy that you'd love to share with our listeners.
So, one of the things that I try to do is, and that I feel has helped me to make it through some difficulties is to always think about doing the job that I have. And I had an opportunity and to learn that in spades. When I was a younger leader, I was leading a team and thought I was really kind of on the and doing well and going kind of up the management track and was asked to do a different job. And it was super important. We had actually a system we needed to buy in like 2 weeks and put in, or we had realized we were going to miss a major multi-million-dollar deadline for another system. And so I got pulled off. I was no longer a manager. I was like back to an individual contributor. And I seriously considered leaving the institution because I was upset feeling like my career was going backwards. And I think probably because I was busy and thinking about having children and young kids anyway, I decided not to go. I'm going to stick it out. I'll just do this and then we'll see. And I think, so I did that job. I worked as hard as I could to try to get that done. I did. I think, it was the shortest RFP we've ever done. Still, I think, date. In an academic medical center, I could actually hold the record maybe because, and I had a lot of help trying to do that, but it really set me up, I think, for future successes, and especially told me that whatever you are asked to do, if you concentrate on that and do it well, you will have more opportunities to do the things that you might feel are more important or more rewarding or more whatever. But if you do what's in front of you, the future will take care of itself.
Wow. That is pure wisdom right there. Where were you 20 years ago when I was making bad mistakes on things and getting mad at people? That's amazing. Well, Phyllis, unfortunately our time has really come to an end, but I will just say you are an amazing role model. I've learned stuff today. I know our listeners will. You are truly a special person, a special leader. Thank you for all you do for The Ohio State University and for my friends in Michigan. They're probably already sick of me saying that now, like 5 times on this podcast. But we greatly appreciate all you do for Chime, for the whole community that you serve, and for the folks there in Ohio. So thank you for being such a special person.
Thank you, Russ. It's been great to talk with you, and I really appreciate the appearance on the podcast.
Thank you. And we would like to thank you for being our listeners to this episode of the Digital Health Leaders Podcast with, once again, one of our truly special leaders in healthcare. You can listen to this and all of our programs on Spotify, Apple, or on our website at chimecentral.org/media. For now, please take care, stay home. If you don't wear your mask, be safe, and God bless.